Good afternoon. It is a Monday, June the 6th, 2016. 1:13 coming up on 1:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Scott Spears along with you on the Now program. We thank Chuck Wepner, legendary boxer, for joining us in Hour 1 on this tribute, during this tribute to the one and only legendary Muhammad Ali. There are sports figures, there are well-known people, there are celebrities who passed away, but this past Friday, June the 3rd, we lost an icon who may have been the most famous person in the world, period, at the age of 74. We have our dear friend Larry Merchant, former boxing analyst with HBO, who covered many of Ali's fights. We're going to get to him momentarily, but before we do, want to play a clip, rather famous clip, of Liberace playing the piano for then known as Cassius Clay, on The Tonight Show with Jack Parr from the 1960s. Let's go back in time.
Well, you recite something and I'll make up the music to it. For a change, do the one about you.
This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks and brags indeedy of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The fistic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans a-running with cash. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you decide to fight him, increase your insurance. This kid's got a left, this kid's got a right, and if he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. And as you lie on the floor while the ref counts 10, you pray that you won't have to fight me again. For I'm the man this poem is about, the next champ of the world, there isn't a doubt. Here I predict, and I know the score, I'll be champ of the world in 64. If Cassius says a mosquito could pull a plow, don't ask how, hit him up.
And what an amazing moment that was. Cassius Clay, who later became Muhammad Ali on The Tonight Show with Jack Parr. We go to legendary former HBO boxing analyst, sports historian, Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
I've been punched in the gut, as a lot of people have, even though we knew it was coming.
You know, Larry, first thing I thought about when I got the news Friday that he wasn't doing so well, you were on this program May the 25th, and when you're on, I don't plan anything, and during that interview, I asked you, just extemporaneously, I don't know why it came in my head, I said, when Ali passes, will it still be a big deal? And we all got the answer this past weekend, unfortunately.
I can't think of another person on earth who would be made that big a deal of, because he transcended all borders and oceans and was a name that resonated in the universe.
Larry, you have known so many boxers through your career. Why, when you got the news Friday night, was it that gut punch?
Well, because I knew him well as a journalist. I was writing in Philadelphia and then in New York during that tumultuous time. And Ali was a great performer, whether he had one person in front of him or a billion. And I had been one of the many ones who had met and known him along the way, and there was a little bit of a personal connection, and I'm not claiming that he was a real friend or that we talked on the phone or that he looked to me for advice, but I was a part of that time, and of course he was a lightning rod in the 60s and 70s, and all of the social change and turmoil of that time. And what he represented as an athlete and showman, and then as a social activist.
Larry, we look at boxing, and there are great boxers, and the connection is always made: Joe Louis, Marciano, Ali, Frazier, Tyson, Mayweather, Sugar Ray Leonard. Ali is different. He just comes to the top for some reason. What is it about him? Does he come to the top for you?
Well, yes, because he was a much larger than life figure. Because he used the platform of the ring and being a champion and being beautiful and black at a time when there was much country, and then of changing his religion and defying the government by becoming a conscientious objector to the unpopular war in Vietnam, and being embargoed from price fighting when he stood up for a principle for over 3 years during his what would have been his prime years. All of that, resonates within us, those who witnessed that and were inevitably a part of all of that was going on at that time.
He won the title, the youngest person ever to win the boxing world title. He was braggadocious. He was unknown. He was not favored to beat Sonny Liston. He was all these things that at that time we don't like in people. The country was segregated. He was braggadocious. We don't like people who brag on themselves. But yet, they wanted to see him. They liked him. What was that?
Well, it was, every time he was on camera, much less in the ring, it was the greatest show on earth. He was funny. He was adorable. He was beautiful. I mean, the actress Candace Bergen once did an essay on Ali when we were in Munich for a fight, and they wanted to dress up a primetime show. She had been doing photo essays on the morning shows, and she called them beautiful. And people in the boxing world were outraged. Who ever heard of an athlete being called beautiful? Handsome maybe, ruggedly good-looking maybe, but beautiful? But he was beautiful. And he poked fun at himself and the whole idea by preening after fights and saying black is beautiful at a time when nobody had heard that. His rhyming and jiving and sometimes his anger and listen, he wasn't a saint. He was childlike in many ways, but didn't mean that everything that came out of his mouth was the pure golden truth, or that he didn't defy himself and contradict himself sometimes. But he was an irresistible force of nature, and I think of him as one of those rare original Americans.
It's very interesting that this rare American got in trouble for not wanting to go to Vietnam, evading the draft. You know, there was some hate at that time, quite a bit of hate for him. How was he able to turn that around?
Well, there was, of course, and whatever we thought of the war, at that time, people went along with our government. It was and the establishment, but now that attitude was crumbling in the streets with street marchers and all kinds of defiance from ordinary people and from unordinary and extraordinary people. And so sides were being called out, and people were taking sides, and change is hard, and so there were people for the change and people against the change, and people who were bowled over by all the change, including how young people were dressing, and including the Beatles and all the new music. It was jarring to a lot of people, and here came this guy who was the heavyweight champion of the world, and performing in a way we never saw as an athlete, and as a showman, and now being involved in things like changing his religion, and being proud of it. A lot of people refused, including in the New York Times, kept calling him Cassius Clay for a long time after he changed his name to Muhammad Ali. And this was electrifying. And so when he fought Joe Frazier, things changed. After he came back from the 3.5-year embargo, he fought a couple of times against good fighters, and then he fought Frazier, who was a thrilling, aggressive fighter who was much liked by everybody as a fighter and a traditional athlete, and meaning that he might have been a surrogate warrior for us, but he let his fists do the talking, and sides were. It was the biggest event I have ever been to, an amazing event that electrified the world, and I think it turned it around. What started to turn around was, after the fight, how Ali dealt with it. He was on the Dick Cavett show, the late night show. In fact, I was supposed to be on right after him, but they left me sitting in the green room because he was so good, and I would have done the same thing as a producer. And he had a slight welt on his right cheek, and he kept saying how Joe Frazier hit him here and hit him there, and he took it like a real sportsman. And I think in that moment, how he dealt with it, people came around to him, that he became more of a beloved figure than a figure of division. And slowly over time, when we saw that he wasn't just bigger, faster, and more graceful and more charming than any human being on the planet, that he also was inside of him was a fierce warrior, and he had those memorable fights with Foreman and so on, and over time he beat back most of the resistance to him.
When I look back at his career, one of the things about the draft thing that I was thinking about over the weekend, Jane Fonda, who is still with us, very big name at the time, still a big name today, what she did in protest of the Vietnam War still haunts her to some degree today. When you look at the history of Muhammad Ali, it was in a lot of the obituaries over the weekend, but people certainly did not hold it against him like they have held it against Jane Fonda for years. What allowed the country to...
Well, there's one thing in saying your government is wrong. The other thing in embracing the other side, which she did.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, the country came around to what was Ali's position and all the anti-war protesters that it was a wrong war. And the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. And he took it with grace, and he went on and took some beatings toward the end of his career. And people, he earned the respect of those who thought he was a disrespectful clown.
And this is one of the interesting things that came of the weekend. It's something to be loved by the fans, but we had Chuck Wepner on it earlier on, and Chuck said he loved Ali, and he's going to the service on Friday. Don King, who has had lawsuits with Ali, says he's going to the service on Friday. George Foreman, who we found out this past weekend had developed a good friendship with Ali. What allowed that to happen with people who he didn't see eye to eye in the ring with or out of the ring, that they still loved him?
Well, time does heal wounds, and he had some real healing intuitions on how to deal with people. And over time, I once emceed an affair, which was a charity affair, and Ali and Fraser was there, and Fraser never forgave him, really, for some of the nasty things that Ali said about him. Called him an Uncle Tom, which really hurt Joe Fraser. And it was all part of Ali trying to get under an opponent's skin, trying to create a narrative for the fight and build it up. But it was nasty. And there they were together, and when Ali was in the room, it was almost like nobody else was there. I was once coming home from a fight in Vegas and waiting for a flight at the airport, and I was with Sugar Ray Leonard, who at that time was an analyst for us, and people were asking for Ray's autograph and wanting to take photographs with him, etc. And Ali, suddenly we hear some noise coming down the room, and it's Ali with a few of his people. He's going to be on the same flight to L.A. And it was almost as if Sugar Ray Leonard didn't exist. That's how the atmosphere changed. Ali was in the room. When he was in the room, we were all there in his movie.
How does a kid who grew up in poverty get that? Are you born with that? Do you develop that? Where did it come from?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it came from his upbringing, particularly his father, who was a sign painter, and you know, who thought he should have been an artist, and maybe thought he was an artist, and was kind of a big personality. Didn't see him much around the fights. Occasionally you did, but you could see that was part of where Ali got his attitude toward life. But it seemed natural. He loved being the center of attention. You've often heard about the magic tricks he does. He did them with me one day. He wanted attention. He wanted to be liked and loved. And he had a real intuition for who the audience was. And he was fierce, and he was funny. And it was all came out in some miraculous super athlete person at a time when communications were changing, television, he intuited from watching Gorgeous George, a popular wrestler at the time. You mentioned earlier that, who was that pianist?
Liberace.
Pardon?
Liberace.
Liberace, who had an act. Liberace may not have been the greatest pianist in the world, but he was probably known in America by more people than any other pianist, because with his candelabra and his costumes. And he saw that this was an opportunity for an athlete, and especially a fighter in a one-on-one sport, and he seized it. And I'll tell you another story to give you an idea of Ali. After he won the Olympic gold medal as a light heavyweight in Rome in 1960, where he, out of the thousands and thousands of athletes there, he became the star personality, having fun with opponents and other athletes from all over the world. He came home, and I've seen a photo of him sitting on the porch of their little house, and there were five or six kids right there that he was obviously charming, and they were little black kids with one young girl who looked like she was stricken with love for this handsome kid having fun with them. Now I have another photo taken 50 years later, when Ali went to the funeral, was taken to the funeral because of his condition, of Angelo Dundee, his famous trainer. And he's with this woman, and he's dressed in a suit, and this is his fourth wife, Lonnie. Lonnie is that little girl in the photo who fell in love instantly with Ali 50 years before.
That's an amazing story. You know, Larry, you were there covering sports during the Sonny Liston fight. The day after he changes his name to Muhammad Ali, it's a big deal, joins what was then called the Black Muslims. What was the blowback on that? What did you think at the time?
I thought, well, he's shocked the world again. There had been some rumors of the change and that it might be announced afterwards, and it scared some people that at that time the Black Muslims, as they were called, the Nation of Islam, they were violently opposed to the nonviolent philosophy of Martin Luther King, and they were basically anti-segregation. They were for the blacks having their own communities. So that was a shock. And then they murdered Malcolm X, who had defected from them weeks before months before the rematch with Sonny Liston. And all of that resonated around that fight. And was Ali in danger, or was Sonny Liston in danger, and so on. So, you know, there were various vibrations all around Ali, and some of it was just pure fun with a big kid who seemed to always have a twinkle in his eye. And some of it was, you know, serious stuff.
You covered Foreman Ali For most people, this is an epic fight for the reason that Foreman, they thought, was unstoppable, that Ali had lost to Frazier. Foreman took care of Frazier like nobody's business, and Ali was going to be taken down. What was the feeling leading up to that fight?
Oh, I think there was a general feeling that this was Ali's last hurrah. Before that fight, I was in Caracas covering the Norton-Foreman fight. Everybody thought Foreman won, and he did, and that would lead up to the Ali fight, and Ali was there. And as a sign of the reality check that Ali was under, he sat down next to me in a lunch, in a kind of luncheonette place in the hotel, and asked me, "Do you think I'm going to be able to retire?" So he knew he was in danger, and unlike many athletes, as the arc of their careers start to go downward, and they say, "Well, I'm going to go on, and I'm going to retire, or I'm not going to retire." He understood the collision between what your head is saying and what your heart is saying, and whether you'd be able to change your life and leave something that defined you and that supported you and so on. So he knew this. He knew the circumstances and the odds. And then we were in Paris on our way to Zaire, and I heard him talking to government of Zaire people, and very understated, almost a whisper, he asked them, "If I lose, will there be a riot?" So Ali knew what he was going into. But he wasn't afraid of Foreman. On the flight to Zaire, again, he sat down next to me and said, after going on the microphone and poking fun at the fact that there were two black pilots, he had never been on a plane with two black pilots, and he didn't know if we would get there safely. Can you imagine this? Have there ever been two black? And we were laughing, and he says to me, "If he doesn't get me in 7, his parachute won't open." He understood how formidable Foreman was, why he seemed indestructible, but he knew that the one crack in his armor was stamina, because of how hard he fought virtually every second of every round. That, to me, was the genesis of the rope-a-dope. I don't think it was a planned strategy. I think it was improvised. I think Ali went to the ropes and around the second round and said, "Okay, let me see if I can live with this guy here." Now, it turned out he could, and you could say it was a genius plan, because Ali was a genius. But there's nobody else on the planet who could have actually exercised that plan. He survived. Few blows landed directly on his head. There were a lot of arm shots that would have broken a lot of other arms. But gradually Foreman wore down. And sure enough, his parachute didn't open after the 7th. Ali knocked him out in the 8th.
As a journalist, having this conversation prior to the bout, when round 7 came about, what were you thinking?
Well, first I have to tell you, Scott, that I was not ringside for the fight. I had gone early on, weeks and weeks before with Ali to Zaire, with the idea that I might write a book about the event. And George Foreman suffered a cut on his eyelid in sparring, and the fight was postponed for, I think, 6 weeks to 2 months, and I came back to the U.S. And when I went to the airport to return to Zaire for the fight, a government official of Zaire told me that I would not be permitted back in the country because of some of the stuff I had written when I was there. I won't go into that. So I watched the fight on theater television. But you could see by the fifth round or so that the volleys from Foreman were gradually becoming fewer and far between, and that Ali would sneak in a quick left hand or a quick right hand, and then he'd go back in his defensive posture against the ropes. And so by the time of the seventh round, the end seemed inevitable, because despite the cries from Ali's own corner, his own people were shocked by this tactic. He had prevailed. He had won the battle of wills. And so it was, by that time, it was a question of when.
Later in life, you became friendly, certainly even worked with George Foreman. Did he ever talk to you off camera about that?
No, he never said anything special to me that he hadn't said in public. I think there was a part of him that was in denial early on. He felt the referee was not, in some way, not fair to him. Then he understood that Ali had outwitted him, if not outhit him. And he came to terms with it and came to recognize what, as only an opponent can, and better than anyone else, what Ali had pulled off and how he had lured him into beating himself.
You know, Larry, what fascinates me about that is that I think everybody, George came back in the 80s and he seemed much more friendly, and he was doing commentary on HBO, and then he had the fight with Michael Moore, and he wore the trunks from that night. Do you think it had huge meaning for him?
Of course. You know, it was, in its own way, it was as extraordinary a victory as Ali had scored over him. You know, he took 10 years off. He came back as, you know, virtually a new man, and in even in some ways a new fighter. He whether it was age or smarts, he was more deliberate in the way he fought, but he was very strong and a very determined person with a great chin. And he won that fight because he had a great chin, because he took extraordinary punishment before he wore down his opponent, Michael Moore, in a different but in the same way as Ali wore him down. He took everything that was coming at him, and he kept coming. That's what determined the outcome of that fight, and with a dramatic knockout.
Starting with Ali at the Olympics, and certainly with the Sonny Liston number one fight, By the time we get to Larry Holmes in 1980, what was that fight like to cover? Because to me, it's seminal in that as ill as Ali was, and as much as you could tell his speech was slowed up, people still thought he was going to win.
Well, that was their experience with Ali. You know, that he would always find a way. And he thought he would always find a way. By that time, I was no longer a newspaper man. And I was with NBC. Or maybe that was even after NBC and I was doing other stuff. I did some occasional HBO stuff, and I did not cover that fight personally. But anybody who followed the game knew that this would not end well for Ali, and of course it didn't.
As a journalist, what was the relationship, in your view, between Ali and Howard Cosell, and how important was that?
I think the relationship was the kind of relationship he had with many newspaper guys like me who got him. Many of the veteran scribes just didn't equate what Ali was doing either in the ring. We had never seen such a big, fast, graceful guy, as I've said, and his showmanship with being a heavyweight champion of the world, the kind of guys they had seen in Joe Louis, in Marciano, etc. And my mind is wandering here. Scott, what was the question? Well,
Cosell and Ali's relationship.
I got lost in my own thoughts.
Cosell and Ali's relationship.
Oh, and Cosell did get him, and Cosell was smart. And when he saw that they could verbally spar with each other, and that Ali could take the most serious questions and turn them around and have fun with it. I forget what famously Cosell once said something to him about how smart he was or something, and Ali said, "Well, you're not so dumb yourself." And they had an act, and Cosell, like many of us in the print world, supported Ali in all the controversy he was generating, and in the sides he took in the social wars going on. It was, I guess, important in helping Ali become Ali.
Many people this past weekend referred to Muhammad Ali as the most famous person on planet Earth. Was he bigger than boxing, the sport itself?
Oh, of course. Nelson Mandela, I'm name-dropping here. In an interview I once, because he had been a boxer, an amateur boxer, in his youth, told me he had been in prison during most of the reign of Ali, and how Ali had inspired him, and how every person in Africa was inspired by him. I mean, during a time when decolonization was going on. It's interesting that even though he took the side of the black Muslims during the civil rights era, that he was very much the face of the civil rights movement. And abroad, can you imagine how it looked to people around the earth that this black person from America was challenging his government, was challenging all kinds of conventions? I mean, he became the greatest advertisement for America it could possibly be. And in fact, in 1980, when the U.S. decided not to go to the Olympics in Moscow because Russia had invaded Afghanistan, the State Department used Ali to try to convince African countries to follow us. I mean, what?
Yeah.
It's bigger than real life. And how this, you know, kid who wasn't very good at school and didn't take it very seriously, in part, I suppose, because he was already a top prospect to, as a kid fighter. To be taken in by the State Department, to be talked to the heads of states, and to take our side in the Cold War. I mean, that's a wow.
The last 30 years of his life, battling with Parkinson's, lighting the torch at the Olympics in the 90s, what is the legacy of those years, and when was the last time you saw him, and what was that like?
Well, you know, it was the grace with which he dealt with his, you know, physical deterioration. That moment was a way of confirming that we got him. Everybody got him. Those who didn't agree with him on certain issues, those who adored him. He was an American hero, legend, icon, bigger than life, as I've called him, Mark Twain with boxing gloves, an original American. I think most people were saddened by his decline, of course. I saw him last, I think he came ringside for a fight at Madison Square Garden, and I don't remember the fight. We hugged. His brain still functioned, but he couldn't really communicate anymore. It was sad, but I knew in my head and my heart that he would do it all over again, even if he knew how it was going to turn out.
That being... go ahead.
And all I can think of now is the immortal words of the bard, "Good night, sweet prince. May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest."
That being said, Larry, the funeral will take place Friday in Kentucky, 2 p.m. President Bill Clinton, Bryant Gumbel, former host of the Today Show, and comedian and movie star Billy Crystal will speak. Chuck Wepner, Don King have said they will be there. I'm sure other people will be there. Will you be there for that event, Larry?
No.
No.
I haven't been invited. I'm just another ink-stained wretch. I could get myself invited, but I feel, you know, I've celebrated Muhammad Ali for most of my life. I don't have to be there. Anybody who wants to go, I get it. They want to be, if they were part of his life, they want to be there at at the end, and it's a big occasion. But I don't feel that as just as a in my role in all of that is just a professional observer that I have to be there. Of course, I'll watch it on television and have the feelings I have. My understanding is that there's one reason that I don't feel that I must be there is I understand that there's going to be a private funeral on Thursday and then the memorial on Friday. If I had been invited to the funeral, I would have gone. There's no reason I should have been invited, but I would have gone. For the memorial, I don't have to be there.
And finally, Larry, how are you and the world going to remember this man? There's never going to be another Muhammad Ali.
Exactly that way.
Larry Merchant, I've been with you a lot of times on the air, and I hope I'll be with you a lot more, but certainly this is a different one. This is seminal, and he might have been the most famous person in the world, and maybe nobody who transcended the world quite like he did. It's very unique, and when it came across the television Friday night, I think the entire world gasped for a minute, because as sick as he was, I think people felt that he was immortal and would go on forever.
He was a part of our lives, everyone.
Thank you, Larry. Larry Merchant. Can't beat that. As we wrap up today, what can we say? Muhammad Ali, the greatest of all time, just like he said it.
Yep.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And on this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actor.